Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 2 on Henri Fayol's General and Industrial Management, chapter 4. To get the text and for more information, go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion. And now back to the conversation.
I was thinking something, rewind a bit, you know, because it seems that a lot of what you're talking about, you know, is whether there should be more example less, if we're setting up the theory or not. It seems that both of Fayol was doing and what Taylor was doing is that they all insist and hit this this key a lot, that this is just the beginning, this is not to mention to be an exhaustive list. And although he says a lot, I think that I keep forgetting a bit. It seems almost like a constant in like the beginning of the of these things emerging, you know, like, which I think we lost a bit, because nowadays when you think about theories and explanations, we wanted it to cover the whole thing, to be very panoramic, and we forget that it's always like a bit tentative and building and grounding. I don't know if there's something that I have or if you share that as well.
I agree with you, and I think I mean that's why I said that being maybe a little overly critical.
So I think that's what we could learn from the classics. They're a bit more tentative and willing to be open to build things and then just having the final answer for everything that we think seems to imply nowadays.
I know, it's quite conclusive in terms of final answers. I mean, he's setting out what is almost an entirely coherent theory of management, even if it's in this weird Marcus Aurelius meditative state of almost that, you know, this is what I did and it worked. And
that's a great description.
Yes, and then they made me angry, but I resisted the temptation. Things like that. But this is a package deal for him, much like it was for Taylor, that here is how I made it work as an executive for this huge mining conglomerate. And take it and basically distribute. It's not the best practice, but it's something like that. It's a case study of a successful management process that he reflected on and put on paper. That's how I see it anyway.
I see.
So the only thing I object to about the, I like when you said phenomenological. I'm a little critical of trying to call it a case study, because he doesn't provide nearly enough evidence and backing for what he's doing. And so I think that's there, right? I'm not saying it's wrong to say that. I think it's more phenomenological. Here's what he thinks about those things and what's important to him. That's really how he's writing.
I didn't say it was a good case study.
A case study. Oh, okay. Good. Then we agree.
Yeah. But that being said, still pondering on, if we were to start a business, the four of us, and we needed to set up a management structure, do you think that we would not be quite well off with these 14 principles? I think we'd be quite good. I mean, we would, maybe as Miranda said, we would need to augment them with some humanistic elements, but other than that, I think they're sound in their direction.
I agree with you. The only one I'm a little fuzzy on, whether depending on the size of the organization involved, is the unity of command. I understand that in principle that you don't want to give, and that was actually Fayol's big criticism of Taylor's, the fact that he's, you know, divided management, all these different groups of people who had to coordinate to give the workers direction, and Fayol said that directly contradicted unity of command. I'm not disagreeing with that, and I think you're right, Dimitri, that all of those principles actually work pretty well together, and we would most likely use them all in some form, perhaps modernized today, with the possible exception of unity of command, in that in smaller firms when you're starting up, I think there's and Miranda can help me on this, I think there's more sharing of responsibilities and things that go back and forth. You're not quite as structured in how things are done in smaller firms.
If I can add to that, it's also something I was thinking before, not only for smaller firms, also for big businesses that have matrix departments. Because the one that I was studying was actually this big product development department. They had like all kinds of product managers and engineers had to answer for different projects. And it would be very tricky to just say, no, we should all guys go back to the typical functional when there is one boss.
I want to build up Pedro's point about the matrix organizations, because I see that a lot in the Navy, and in particular, it's called project management, where you take people from some functional area and you put them in a project, and we say, oh, they report strictly to the project manager, and the project manager is in charge of the overall goals and meeting the goals and the organization. And that's not really true. We don't talk about it out loud, but functional organizations provide the training and development for these people. They actually they're not going to work forever in this project. At least in many organizations are going to report back to there. And so there's this tension that goes on between, oh, yes, I work for the project team and I'm supposed to take my orders from the project leader, but I have people who write my performance evaluations, decide whether I'm going to get a bonus, those kinds of things back in the original organization. So I think it's a tricky issue. I'm not saying fail's wrong. I'm just saying it's a tricky issue. How do you manage that? Because I think that's a feature of modern work that is very common today. And product development teams is a really good example.
In terms of having more than one boss, Fail doesn't approve of that at all. He thinks this is the source of all organizational inefficiency, frustration, and evil. To be fair,
I was wondering when you were going to say the evil word.
I was also going to add on this multidisciplinarity aspect of project management, that in a world that is increasingly complex, also in terms of technologies, the idea of unity of command, of direction, to some extent can probably be like jeopardized, because different kinds of experiences and knowledge and forms of knowledge are needed. So that is something that when we need to take Fail to nowadays business setting, yeah, can be discussed.
What do you think Fail would have to say about all that?
I don't know. I think his principles are still limited by the fact that he took into consideration his experience, which was the mining industry. And from reading his principles, the only other forms of organizations that he mentions is something governmental or state-led. And that is the only form he mentions a couple of times. So I think he'd be curious.
And he's not a fan.
Yes, that's true. I noticed that one too. Yes, I think he'd be curious to see other industries.
Well, what I was thinking, because I went through my notes, I went back to my notes now about this whole thing of units of command, and it seems that he doesn't really foresee matrix organizations or project management base, because what he's hitting at more, and that's what he complains, is about not respecting the line of command. So if, I don't know, say someone higher up would go straight to a employee without talking with the foreman or supervisor of that employee before, or when you have departments that don't have well-defined responsibilities, one might be dealing with the same area that the other is. So it's much more a problem of design, and I'm sorry I keep insisting that, but I really feel that there's a lot about organizational design inbuilt into, although he's in principle talking about management.
Can I ask something with regard to the idea of design and unity of command and, yeah, all these principles? What did you think, mm-hmm, of, how do you think the principle of initiative can come into play? Because to a certain extent, I found it a bit, I don't know, something difficult to put into the picture of the previous principles. So I was wondering.
You have a point. It's contradictory.
Well, I think the principle of initiative mainly has to do with discouraging managers from micromanaging their subordinates. So it's not initiative in a disruptive kind of way, but initiative in a delegational kind of way.
I got the sense it was a little more than that. I think what you address is true. But he writes on page 39, and I don't know if these page numbers don't match the PDF version, but he talks about the initiative of all represents a great source of strength for the business. So, I mean, I think that still follows from what you said, but I think Miranda was on to something when you say, okay, well, on one level, you want discipline, you want unity of command, you want this scalar chain, which I thought was interesting the way he illustrated that. And I think one of the things that we've seen in modern organizations is that companies that put a lot of effort into those things of scalar chain and centralization and those kinds of things actually diminish initiative. It's hard to get people to take initiative when they have all these other things they have to contend with. And I can't quote any recent research, but I have read some about that it makes a pretty big difference.
I had this doubt, especially going through the sixth principle of subordination of individual interest to general interest, where the three means that specified are firmness, agreements, and constant supervision. But I would think that if I were to set up a business, I would also like an ongoing discussion, an ongoing conversation, which could be something to develop initiative. So I was kind of struggling to see how these things fit in.
Actually, in that principle, I put a note. So it says number 6, subordination of individual interest to general interest. And I added in the beginning activity of. So the interesting part here being that it's a continuous process of subordinating individual interests to the general interest. And to me, this is evident through the 3 points he puts at the end of this section, that means of effecting this subordination are, number 1, firmness and good example on the part of superiors. So the upstanding nature of managers comes in here. Then agreement as far as possible. Okay, that makes sense. But that is backed up by constant supervision. And then I have in brackets, because the other two cannot be relied upon. And this rings to me so much in modern organizations of things like internet browsing filtering and CCTV and other forms of information control. That, okay, you have good managers and we have a contract, but people still cannot be relied on, possibly. So control is necessary, at least as a means of this Foucauldian panopticon to indicate who is in charge and who is, well, who isn't, I guess.
I was just going to ask Dimitri, can you explain the panopticon? Many of our listeners may not know what you mean by that.
Yes. In the 18th century, English architect Jeremy Bentham designed the thing, which originally was a prison structure that allowed guards to watch prisoners without knowing when they were being observed, so that prisoners felt that they might be under watch at all times. So it was basically a circular-shaped building with all the cells located at the perimeter and a single watchtower at the center. So the key part of it was not only that the cells faced inwards so that inmates were on full display, but also that they would not be able to tell whether they were being observed from the tower or not. So this way they would have to act in a way as if they were being observed all the time, even if in reality the tower would be vacant. It's kind of like one of those one-way mirrors that were so common in movies 20 years ago, anytime an interrogation took place. I think these are now mainly replaced with a CCTV camera just relentlessly staring at a person. But in terms of the text, unity of command, for instance, I think is one such expression of the panopticon for FAIL, because one way unity of command is expressed is through organizational charts and scalar chains, which basically open up the entire organization in all its human complexity to the immediate and all-encompassing examination, so that if there are any deficiencies in the division of labor or communication or anything like that, they can be swiftly identified, located, and corrected. A modern incarnation of the panopticon, I think, is most associated with the French philosopher Michel Foucault. He observed that managers and foremen would normally stand in offices high above the shop floor to observe activity below. I think panopticon is most discussed in his work Discipline and Punish, where he says something to the effect that panopticon creates a consciousness of permanent visibility as a form of power, thus replacing locks, bars, chains, and that sort of thing. In modern offices, the panopticon persists, for instance, in the form of cubicles, where open workspaces may foster collaboration, but also facilitate employees being observed by their managers and their peers. And more recently, this idea took form online. It's not uncommon for IT departments to install keystroke loggers and web proxies to monitor employees' computing activities. One other thing that's related that I want to mention is normative management, and this is closely aligned to both the panopticon and FAIL's idea on unity of direction, and that whole thing about manager being a good man that we discussed. So normative management is something like managing the thoughts and attitudes of employees, and for instance, Taylor was all about managing actions in the most efficient scientific way, but with FAIL we can already see tendencies to manage attitudes of employees at the expense of managing actions. So FAIL is not as concerned with the one best physical way of performing a task, but he does emphasize things like experience at work. Although this is probably related to the different levels of operational engagement that Fayol and Taylor had, but still. Fayol is much more interested in fostering an ideologically committed workforce above anything else, and I don't know if I would go as far as to suggest that Fayol wants to build regimes of truth, in Foucault's terms, but I sense he's certainly in the ballpark of those ideas, especially with that whole administrative ubermensch business that I keep coming back to. Normative management is something of a big deal in management theory, especially starting with the early 80s when the study of things like organizational culture and memory really took root. There's this famous book by Kunda on engineering culture where he shows in great detail how organizations may attempt to influence and shape thought processes and perceptions of their employees through various mechanisms, including observation and correction, in ways that both Fayol and Foucault would certainly recognize and understand. But what I did want to say is that in relation to this subordination principle, where you have the constant supervision and backing up otherwise upstanding moral character and agreement between the parties, is that in the initiative section where you said initiative of all is great strength to the business, my question is, who counts as all? Do you think it's the entire organization or just the managerial core? Because I think it's just the management that he has in mind.
I think you could go either way on that. My view is when he says all, my general approach is unless he specifically limits it to presume that he might mean the entire organization, but that doesn't mean my interpretation is any more valid than yours.
I think that the all here tends to be more the leaders because I appreciate the whole critical reading that Dimitri has given, but when I read that whole thing about subordination, I was not so captured by this problem that I now think I see, but more to the fact that sometimes if an employee follows the direction of the supervisor, it doesn't mean that he's doing the best for the corporation as a whole, because the boss might be just concerned with a specific performance metric, and that is naturally perhaps not going to help, for instance, a project overall.
Well, that doesn't go into the system because, for one, superiors and managers are good people, and that's why I used the term evil previously. Is this almost religious dichotomy going on here of a good man? And the other thing is that the not the unity of command, but unity of direction, that if everyone's going for the same objectives, theoretically, and we know that's not how it works in practice, so theoretically, there shouldn't be a situation where a superior issues a directive that is counterproductive to the overall performance of the business.
I think he assumes that could happen, but you weed all that out because you get people of higher integrity, right? That just kind of jumped off the page at me, saying, and I think we've all kind of identified, he's got this very optimistic view of organizations and that I don't think it's necessarily, you know, I can't say he thinks they take care of themselves, but he didn't really address it. So Miranda said earlier, he brings them up and then he doesn't go any further with it.
Question becomes then, so how do you construct, you know, how do you construct everyone going the same direction?
Well, he does talk up in there about forecasting and the weekly plans and those kinds of, you know, the weekly meetings of the senior leaders. So I'm not saying that's how it's done. I'm just saying I think he's trying to address that. And he doesn't really say, okay, well, the chief executive will meet with his subordinates or the direct reports, and then all of that will happen everywhere in the organization. He doesn't really say. I mean, you could go either way with that and say, well, it was only the senior leaders that's always focused on, or that the implication is that would be replicated in other places in the chain of command. So he talks about how the plan, earlier in the book, he talks about how the plan and forecast helps get people aligned. But there's a lot to it.
And if I can add an academic perspective, I think what's interesting in this building, this whole system, is that it starts the idea of thinking the corporation as a whole, thinking the corporation as a unit in itself that has different parts that have to act in a certain way. And that's what becomes what we know today as, you know, organizational scholarship. You know, it's this kind of view towards the corporation that makes it possible.
I think you're right. And I think Fayol makes a good case for what we are doing as management scholars, in that we believe there is value in getting these ideas written out in the public forum and discussed amongst other people. That's as a way of generating new ideas. And I think Fayol is a early proponent of that, because he's trying to do the same thing. He's trying to get his ideas out there and and make them accessible to other people, which is something Admiral Rookover never did.
In reference to the organization as a unit that you said, Pedro, it's even more interesting than that to me in that it's a body. It's not a... All right, so these days I think maybe there isn't too much of a distinction, but and I'm not sure whether there was before, but he repeatedly talks about organization as a body with organs, and the more sophisticated the organization, the more specialized organs performing their respective duties there are. So it's a deeply biological metaphor that he's operating with, which is at the same time very, I guess, militaristic.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. I think in part, when I think about that, I read it as, you know, he was... This way to see systems and big things was very common in social sciences back then, you know, like Emile Durkheim, which is the one of the first sociologists, also, and many others referred to society as this big organ. These are, you know, so these are biologist metaphors were common, I think, in those times. But I wonder the connection of the military, you know, where if he, like, if he had an experience, if he modeled implicitly it after the military, what it could be the influence from that?
Well, his father was a French military officer, and that's Fayol was the reason Fayol was born in Turkey was his father was there working construction projects. And so I don't know how much of that he was aware of when he was growing up, but certainly it has some influence.
What I want to say is that one, the difference between a business such as Fayol is writing about and the society is that while you said society was seen by Durkheim and others as an organism, right? So organism can be spores or anything that's, you know, not necessarily one. But for Fayol, an organization was a body. It was one. The esprit de corps is the spirit of the body, literally. So that's one thing where a lot of this unitarism of one direction, one command, one brain, one body, that sort of thing comes from. That and this is very different from how we see organizations these days, especially if you look at things like knowledge. We no longer think of knowledge as an agglomeration of individual brains into one. I mean, we mostly don't anyway. Well, I think with militaries, at that time, that was probably the most organized institution, wasn't it? I mean, the military began organizing things like homogeneous uniforms, marching orders, tactics and strategy designed to function in a concentrated manner. So it's not necessarily surprising that he's drawing inspiration from things like that. You know, von Clausewitz wrote about things like pure war and pure military, and these theories of ideal types, as we keep referring to them, are, I think, an echo of that. But it is interesting how he is describing this image of one body with reference to this militaristic reflection. And I don't know, I can't get my finger on what exactly is it that is intriguing me there, but there is this interesting incoherence, I think, between thinking of a collection of people as one, as an, and as multiple at the same time.
I don't like get the multiple part.
Right, so we have these different levels of managers, and we have explicit acknowledgement heterogeneity of not even organs, but individuals, right? And yet, at the same time, they are expected to function as a single, well, not a single cell organism, but something quite basic and unidirectional.
I see what you mean, yeah. You can think that even in terms of the division of work, you know, that, you know, we have to put all these things together, and yeah.
Well, and Fayol talks about, this sort of jumped at me, right, jumped off the page at me when you talked about the division of labor, and he said it was part of the natural order of things. I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm not saying I disagreed, it's just, I just thought that was interesting that he would use that as an example. So it goes back to Dmitry's reference to the biological aspect of what he was talking about.
There was some other principle that was part of natural order. Do you remember which one?
Might have been centralization.
I think so.
I don't have it right in my notes, but I do believe that's what he was talking about. But yeah, it's centralization belongs to the natural order. Yep, came right out and said it. That was on page 33.
So that's back to this whole one multiple thing that I think I was trying to articulate, that it's you're both acknowledging on one level the differences and the multitude of variables within the business, but at the same time, there is a very restricted sort of center of initiative, not initiative in the principle that he put, but in terms of setting strategy and coming up with different ways of implementing it.
Maybe that's the understated thing, that, you know, while for Taylor, managers were important because they're the ones that understand the work to be done fully. Here, the managers are important because they are the ones that are going to guide, almost like, you know, leadership kind of style. They're the ones to show the way, and you have to follow that because they're the ones that really know where to go.
Not just a way, the way, right? They're supposed to be just one direction everybody's going.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's actually the weakest thing, you know, in the whole idea.
So one thing I'd like to do, I mean, we've been through many of the principles, and I think, so here I propose something we do. Let's all talk about the couple top principles, you know, things that just stood out the top to, you know, to us, not necessarily because we think they're the most important, but just because they resonated somehow. And I'll start. So the one I thought, the number one thing that resonated with me, and primarily it's because of my practitioner or military background, was esprit de corps. And because that's, so you talk, practitioners talk about that a lot, not necessarily in that same language, but more like the spirit of the organization or getting people motivated. And I thought, in essence, what it captures, this is why I thought it was really important. It captures the idea that motivation is an important factor in getting superior results. That's something that matters to people. And matters to an organization. At least that's the way I read it.
In the supplement, I think I also referred to it as culture. Culture management.
It's interesting because I also like Spirit Corp a lot, but I didn't read it in any way like that. I didn't think about culture and motivation. For me, again, you have this fixed idea maybe today, I don't know, for any reason, about organizational design, organizational structure. And for me, because he talks about two things, one is the written communication thing that we said, and the other one is that how personnel should not be split up, you know. And I was thinking about that because other people, like Thompson, when he talks about coordination organizations, how you put all these different division of labor and different tasks together, they hit a lot on that note that you have to design teams and groups depending on how much interdependence they have among themselves. So it follows that you have to design the things and create teams in a way that the people that are more likely to be working depending on each other tasks, they have to be put together. So for me, Spirit of Corps follow from that, because once you create an infrastructure in which the people they are interacting continually are placed together physically and within the same department, that's going to follow because they're going to feel that they are working towards the same goal, the same, because their tasks are visibly interdependent.
Yeah, I like it.
This is not something how I saw it. That's very cool. So you're suggesting that instead of training the whole organization in esprit de corps, you're taking parts that are compatible and clustering them.
Well, I think you can build esprit de corps that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. Has that been your experience?
Yes, it has. That many times you have actually a better control over esprit de corps with the smaller groups. And you look at Steve Jobs, for example, when he was recruiting people at Apple to work on the Macintosh. You know, it was this whole idea they want to be pirates, and of course, being a Navy guy, that bothers me a little bit, but that's okay. But they wanted to. You know, he went on to pick the talent. Because I don't think pirates are good things, but there you go. So I get the mythical sort of swashbuckling atmosphere. So, all right, so it's more of the Errol Flynn, you know, kind of version of pirates.
So, wait, pirates are not like Johnny Depp. What are you talking about?
I'm so disappointed.
I hate to break this to you, but no, they're not generally. It's more like the guys off the beach in Ethiopian Eritrea and those kind of. It's a tough. Captain, forget the name of the movie where they. The cruise ship cat or the merchant ship captain gets, you know, kidnapped, but they're more like those guys. That's what
Phillips or something, like. Yeah,
Captain Phillips, that was it. So it's more like the Captain Phillips movie. And so being a Navy guy and, you know, responsible for enforcing security and keeping people from getting kidnapped, I have a little trouble with that. But Jobs put a lot of energy into motivating the team, picking the right people, and showing their distinctiveness. So I think it goes back to what Pedro was talking about, when you're kind of creating a team and kind of creating that vision for people.
If you want, that's actually the basis of the idea of community of practice. You know, it's because you share you have this common task and common tools, and you implicitly start to share ideas and tips and so on and so forth, and creates, you know, the sense of cohesiveness. And you don't necessarily have to have that in the beginning. It's the activity that creates that. So
What is a community of practice, Pedro?
A community of practice is a group of people that share the same activities and tools and perhaps object of work. So, for instance, it can be found both in organizations but also outside that. So a group that has a common interest on, I don't know.
Do you know any four individuals that might be like that?
Maybe some people. I heard about this podcast talking about organization. No, that's a little community of practice.
Well, and then the listeners that we're trying to cultivate, we want them to be part of our community of practice as well, and that's why we're trying to appeal to practitioners as well as scholars.
Yes,
because that I think the other thing, one additional feature I would add to community of practice that you described, Pedro, is a means of communicating, right? A means of getting together and sharing ideas.
Yes, yes.
So this podcast is a way to do that.
Yes, yes. So if I would think about other communities of practice I belong in, so I love baking. So of course I follow blogs and all kinds of forums in which people exchange ideas. Or you and me, Dimitri, you all both part of this research group here in Warwick, the Icon one. So we also have this because we work on similar topics and so on and so forth. So that would be good. Two examples from my daily life of communities of practice.
So I just thought that, managers would obviously be an example of a community of practice. And, for Fayol, certainly it would qualify. And what he said about communication, do you think his nitpickiness about, abusing the means of written communication is directed to not having this community of practice polluted by useless things? Maybe control over the distribution of information has to do with maintaining this new and at that point still fragile institution of management that he was trying to set up.
So how would written communication jeopardize that?
Well, if you're sending videos of cats on YouTube, equivalent of Fayol's days, instead of talking about commanding, controlling.
I think it's the opposite, because when you first hinted at written communication, what came to my mind is that it's because you want people to share and to be familiar with each other and feel that they're all in this together, to use an expression. You want them to interact face to face, and the written communication would, in a way, hamper that. Do you get what I'm hitting at?
Yeah, so to give a slight practitioner flavor to that, one of the things that I do when I want to communicate something complex to people is that if I have the opportunity to do so, I will go speak to them face-to-face, or I'll call them on the telephone first and talk to them about the idea and give them the background and what I'm trying to accomplish to get some common ground. And that serves a couple purposes. One, you get a chance to find out what they think and see if they have any concerns about what you're trying to do. But you establish a connection, right, Peter? You talked about that several times, the importance of having a kind of connection between people. And then the second thing is, from a purely efficient point of view, you can skip all that stuff in your email once you've established that connection. So now you can go to just, I need you to do this, or I need you to go to this step, or here's this file, or go do this other kind of thing. And so that, of course, I'm a big believer in efficient, making efficient written communications, but also verbal as a prelude to that. Because, and I often will tell people that when I finish this conversation, okay, I'm going to follow this up with an email or something I want, the thing I need you to do. And I'll say, by the way, this conversation saved me about 5 pages of writing, typing an email. And it was interactive as well. So you could find out what the person was thinking. So there's a practitioner aspect of that.
I think this connects this whole thing that we're talking about on interaction and kinds of practice with another principle that I think is one that also was very relevant for me, which is the scholar chain, which he also calls in brackets the line of authority, in which he gives that example that when you have two different workers that have something to talk about or discuss, instead of going all the way up the ranks with the high up officer and then all the way down to the one from that different department, they just could just interact. The important thing being that the two foremen, the supervisors, are to be aware about the decisions and the whole things that are going on, which, as I said before, is a lot about empowerment, a lot about, it's a different view of management that is much more about creating and nurturing the links for the informal interactions to take place, instead of not being so rigid and needing to go through all the time the managers and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because I think that's an implicit admission that the scalar chain of command doesn't work for everything. And and Fayol talked about that kind of bridging of communications as a gangplank, which I thought was interesting, because of course in sailor terminology, you know, walking off a gangplank is, you know, kind of what the pirates do. They make you walk off the, you know, walk off the ship with a plank. But I will say, from a practitioner point of view, I did that all the time in my career, because what I found out was, in the organization I was in, if you waited till the other person would get the information, it would almost never get it in time. And so I spent a lot of time learning how to go across those, you know, those organizational boundaries in a way that was safe. And oftentimes, you know, I couldn't go back to my manager and say, oh yeah, by the way, I told so-and-so, you know, I told Pedro to do this, and I just want you to know. Many times you can't do that. Because people get angry with you. And so I would just make sure. But I think there's a great value in that. And I think Farrell acknowledges that, because he gives such a good, it's one of the very concrete examples that he gives. He actually gives a diagram of how to bridge that. I thought, man, that's pretty impressive. He obviously thinks that's something important.
What is interesting there is, from my research, though, is that a lot of the work that the product managers do on a daily basis exactly to connect people, because when you are in a large organization, so the department I was looking at, there was like 4,000 people, it's own engineering department, and some people for one group might not have no idea with whom they need to talk in another group, because they know that they need an input from that group, but they just don't know who is the person. So the product manager is, in this case, a bridge to get to that person, which he doesn't talk about so much, because it seems it's understated here. Like, the managers are much more about control and pay and the whole thing of, you know, authority, and never how actually the managers sometimes are the enablers of the work, of the tasks of the workers, because they're the ones that they can put them in contact with other workers.
Well, Fail is willing to allow gangplanking, or gang, what was it?
Gangplanking? Yeah.
As long as a permission of immediate superiors is in place. So what you did, Ralph, how you described it, I think would not chive well with Fail.
I agree. I was ignoring Fail, because in practice, remember, he assumes that you have all the right managers in place. They all want to do the right thing. They all have, you know, unity of direction, because you've got these saints as managers who all have high integrity and are working for the best interests of the organization. And what I found out as a practitioner is that the world's a lot messier than that. So, yes, I recognize that Fail doesn't really endorse that, but I'm saying, from personal experience, it is not always practical to go to the person's boss that you talked about and say, oh, yeah, by the way, I told so-and-so. I mean, there's many times you should and can, but there's other times when it won't work very well for you. And that's one of those kind of judgment experience things, because I've done that well and very poorly and suffered the consequences.
But it shouldn't be a problem as long as you have unity of direction, should it? I mean, because what you're doing effectively in circumventing this rule, not having permission in place from your superior, is you're destroying the scalar chain.
Well, I wouldn't say you're
but
destroying
as
it.
As long as you're going in, well, maybe that's a bit strong, sure, but
yeah.
You're violating
it. Yeah, or diminishing it, okay.
But, all right, undermining, whatever.
Yeah.
But as long as you're doing it for the benefit of the organization, you know, that should be okay. Shouldn't it? So from that perspective, these two principles may be duplicated, and we can do with 13 principles.
So I would say yes, in many organizations and many circumstances, what Dimitri said is true. But remember, we talked about Fail having this kind of idealized idea, or at least a projection of how organizations function. So what he completely leaves out in big organizations, and I'm sure it existed back in the time when he worked, is competing agendas. And Pedro talked about that earlier, where people had, you know, other priorities and things they wanted to go work on. So if you had, I think unity of direction is an ideal, but often not seen in practice. And if you had that, sure, it would work out great. But oftentimes you find out people have many other agendas, and getting information to the frontline workers isn't, you know, on top of their agenda. And so I found out, just a quick example, I found out when I needed somebody else, some other organization or somebody in another scalar chain of command, scalar chain to do something, it would be a disaster for me if I waited for their boss to tell them. And so I couldn't afford that. So I found ways to go communicate to that person what needed to happen in such a way that their boss wouldn't necessarily find out, but the work could get done, because of the complexity of the organizational, you know, arrangement. So it gets messy in the real world.
Yes. I was just going to say that, you know, the way that Dimitri was saying this, it should be fine if all had, like, unity of direction. It almost reads as if, as long as it's in the name of the organization, it's going to be fine. So it becomes like this super justification.
Don't you think that Fayal basically simplified just saying that it's the economic interest of the organization that is at the first place.
Yeah, good point.
I think yes, but I think there is also an ideological element to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think he oversimplified that.
But can you expand on that, Miranda? Because you brought a lot about this whole thing of economic interest, so I'm curious what you have in mind now.
I think it's... I think he was kind of aware of the presence of competing agendas, but just simplified it like that, under one grand economic interest.
But the problem for me is that... Because when I think about competing agendas, it's not only political things. For me, it's just because certain things pull in different directions. So, you know, in the case of product development, if you decide that you are not going to use a design that had been established, it's going to create more work for a different group, you know, and it's like, okay, should we go back and create more work and delay the schedule, just go with this design that you have in place that is not ideal? So it's just about trade-offs as well, you know, so it's not about little politic making, it's more also that there is always trade-offs in choice. So it's hard to know what's going to be really the best.
Yes, but I was thinking that in Fayol's mind, the best is the one that gives more profit to the firm.
Ah.
At least that's how I read it. At least that's how I read his possible solution to the problem of competing agendas, for instance.
But the problem is then, how can you measure sometimes what is it going to be? It's not always clear.
Well, it is an efficient bottom line that you try one way of doing things, you look at the profit and loss statement, and you try something else. And
principle that I was, that most attracted my attention was definitely the one of stability of tenure of personnel.
Okay.
Just for the idea of stability of the firm, of keeping people in their position, giving them the chance to master. That was definitely my top one.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of authority and discipline, even though I've got some issues with it, but I understand the importance, let's put it that way.
It's maybe just me, but I feel that, you know, it's a bit revolutionary, this whole idea of tenure, you know, that you should keep people in place in order enough for them to learn the work, and even someone that's not maybe great, but it's, at least you can, it's reliable and has been there for a while and know how things go on. It's better than just someone that's great, but it's not very, you know, stable. It's almost counterintuitive. Imagine that we all, like, for a long time, I don't know if they're still very popular, but many, like, management gurus were talking about that you have to hire the best people. So it's all about, you know, the poaching talent and the war for talent and writing the right people. So it's talking something different. It's talking about, it's more and more long, you have to have a more long-term idea. That's not necessarily a team of A stars doesn't make necessarily a good team. It's more like the team has been playing for a while that it's a good team.
Yeah.
For me, this is rooted in what Miranda brought up, and I mentioned that this is taken in isolation, that there is no pressures of competition and excelling in performance of any kind, just being good enough long enough. That's how I see it anyway. It's very mellow. It's keeping the status quo, right? Because one of the ways we think of management is coping with unexpected circumstances. And
yes.
Coping means negating them to no detriment of the organization. So the chapter 4 of General Industrial Management to me is a giant manual on how to keep status quo in an organization that's doing well enough.
That is interesting, because a lot of things written about management is a lot about change and promoting change and bringing the manager to rearrange everything. So it's interesting. I haven't realized that, to be honest. Thank you.
Well, and I tend to agree with Dimitri that that's the way Chapter 4 can be viewed. But remember, Fayol, actually, when he was the director general of the corporation, it was not doing well, and many changes were needed to keep them productive. I don't think that undermines Dimitri's point. It's just that I think Farrell was talking more about, you know, general stuff. You don't see that kind of turmoil and change really in the principles. So that's why I think it's interesting that he came from that, had that kind of experience, but wrote about the way Dimitri says.
Because we don't know about Fayol before he became the general manager. What we do know is that he was very successful in implementing new safety procedures in the mines, in the coal mines themselves. So maybe he wasn't changing things in a way that change management is understood as a superstar comes in and just cleans house. Maybe he was already working on the basis of these principles. So again, sort of reorienting something that wasn't working to, that wasn't functioning properly towards a way that he thought is, better. So I don't think we can, if he was a general exec at a different company and then he came in and shuffled things around, maybe I would be more comfortable in assigning the what we now understand as change management practices to him. But I think he was just molding this company to a way that he thought is... But it's a subtle point, and I see how it can be contested by saying that, well, that's what everyone does. You know, no one comes into an organization to just, you know, make a lot of noise and make a mess of it. But do you see what I mean? That
But I think there is a romanticization of this idea of the manager is going to bring the solution and change things and shuffle things. At least I saw something in of my research a bit. You know, there is the idea that, you know, the guy is going to come, we're going to hire some consultants, they're going to really show us the way and everything's going to be fine.
Transformational leader, yeah.
Yes, if Fail brought Taylor in, that would be very interesting.
Yes. So what is your favorite or more interesting principle, Dimitri?
Right, well, I think the most I like number one, especially when he called managers the good people. So on the one hand, that's quite pleasing, given what we do. But on the other hand, it's just a very interesting philosophical statement in relation to how managers or people informally in charge relate to their subordinates. And the other one was the subordination of individual interest to general interest. I really liked how he sort of supported this whole principle with constant supervision.
Mm. So I think we've all had a really good... I learned a lot of stuff by listening to you talk about the things that you found interesting and kind of related to your research. So I really appreciate the perspectives. And I think at the time Thayil wrote, his ideas were revolutionary concepts for organizations and management, because in addition to the 14 principles, we talked about how he articulated five core elements of management that are not really mentioned in chapter 4, but I think it's worth, you know, I think they're in the advanced reading, but I should mention them now. And that's planning, organizing, command, coordination, and control. And those things may actually be, you could consider them themes for the 14 principles, but they all work together in, as a, maybe as a system or as a practical way of doing things. So I think it's important. I'm glad we discussed Fayol, because I didn't know about him. He's not really taught in the program I'm in. Bernard is what we talk about. And I think it's great to have that additional perspective that I would not otherwise had. So I really appreciate what you guys contributed in your thoughts today.
Well, thank you.
I think actually it's very, in a way, interesting to just see, you know, how all these things came to be, you know, how they start, how people start thinking about organizations that way. So for me, it's always like a history lesson, but also it makes me think of how contemporary things are and how we can compare with how they are today. So it's always like pleasant.
Yes, I totally agree. I think the best part is seeing how writers and authors that have become very, very, very famous started the discussion on management and how to manage people within organizations.
That marks the conclusion of episode 2. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on future episodes, our blog, and show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a positive review on iTunes, subscribe to our feed, and tell your friends about this podcast. You can also get in touch with us on our website, Twitter, Facebook, and on LinkedIn. Thank you, and we hope to see you next time as we delve into psychology and discuss A Theory of Human Motivation by Abraham Maslow.